Good afternoon. It's Mountain Edition, all the news from the week here in the Roaring Fork Valley, coming at you in the next half hour. I'm Allison Bechtesh.
And I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy.
Lots of news happening this week. Eagle County wants to get the ball rolling on new mental health services even before a new pot tax starts trickling in. And a new assessment shows that catastrophic wildfire is likely in Pickens County. And the county has new plans to reduce that risk.
Also, there's a new minimum wage in Colorado, and we'll talk about the effects here in the valley. Plus, female veterans who are here for Military Ski Week have a new mission, helping each other negotiate the challenges of being a woman home from war.
The biggest stories from this week coming up on Mountain Edition. The U.S. Grand Prix competition kicked off yesterday at Snowmass Ski Area. Elizabeth, you spent some time up there yesterday morning.
Yeah, I was up there for the Women's Ski Superpipe qualifiers. There were some very talented athletes up there.
It's been a difficult year for snow, though. How is the course looking?
Well, a lot of work went into getting Snowmass ready, and SkiCo had a bit of a late start because of warm temperatures this winter, but they got all their snowmaking together and completed, and it's looking pretty solid as this is a pretty important event.
The Grand Prix is actually a qualifier for the Olympics, and as you reported this week, local athletes are vying for spots.
Local skiers Torin Yader Wallace and Alex Ferreira and Aspen High School senior Cassidy Jarrell are competing in ski superpipe today. This is the third of five Olympic qualifiers. The top three athletes, based on a point system, will represent the U.S. in Pyeongchang. Headed into the Grand Prix, Yader Wallace is ranked first and Ferreira fourth. Aspen Valley Ski and Snowboard Club athlete Robert Pettit will compete in Snowboard Superpipe Thursday. Former AVSC riders Jake Pates and Chris Corning will be vying for Olympic spots. Pates is ranked second in Snowboard Superpipe, and Corning is ranked first in Slopestyle. Events run through Sunday. Allison, you know how we hear StoryCorps interviews on Friday mornings on Morning Edition?
Yeah, I call it Wake Up and Cry.
Well, StoryCorps is actually in town collecting stories about the Aspen Art Museum. Claire Woodcock reports.
Facilitators from the National Storytelling Service are recording a series of conversations meant to represent an oral history of the museum. The privilege is part of the museum's National Medal Award from the Institute of Museum and Library Services. Heidi Zuckerman is the Aspen Art Museum's director and CEO. She says conversations have included one of the founders of the museum and community members with stakes in the museum's education programs. She was paired with Larry Marks, a longtime supporter of the Aspen Art Museum. They spoke about the museum's evolution.
Larry asked me as sort of the final question. He asked me, knowing what I know now, if I would do it again. And I said 1,000%.
Those conversations will be available through the Library of Congress later this year. Claire Woodcock, Edlis Neeson, Arts and Culture Desk.
January 1st meant a new year and a new minimum wage in Colorado. It's now $10.20 an hour, up 90 cents from last year. The wage will continue to rise each year until it hits $12 an hour in 2020. Producer Kristen Kay sat down with Wyatt Orm to talk about the effects the new wage might have in the Roaring Fork Valley.
So how much will the new wage affect Valley businesses?
I reached out to several different employers. I couldn't really find many that even pay minimum wage. Mark Gould of Gould Construction told me that he starts his workers off at $17 per hour. The Roaring Fork School District told me that none of their employees have been making less than $10.20 an hour, so these new minimum wage increases don't impact them. A spokesperson for City Market told me that in the Roaring Fork Valley, their entry-level positions all start out higher than minimum wage, and this is, they say, because the cost of living is so high. I spoke with an economist at CU Boulder. Her name is Tara McKinnish, and she said that this is not surprising. The Roaring Fork Valley has lots of employers, but not a lot of workers, so the market wage is higher. In other words, employers have to compete for employees.
So this 90-cent increase is actually just for this year, and there are more increases coming. So how are employers reacting to that?
I asked this question to Eric Brotherson. He does HR for the Glenwood Springs Adventure Park and Iron Mountain Hot Springs. He told me that he does have employees who make minimum wage, so even the newest increase will impact the business. It's not going to impact them a lot, but the eventual rate of $12 an hour, he said, could be problematic.
Right now, $12 an hour, that's a very good rate of pay.
So should low-skill workers be making a rate of $12 an hour? That's kind of the question. And this speaks to something that economist Tara McKinnish told me. She said that the real tension with minimum wage increases comes when the increase exceeds the market wage. On the one hand, this helps workers better afford the cost of living. It can also, however, force employers to find new ways of making up these new costs that they have. So maybe they raise prices, but if they can't raise prices, they might find ways to use technology to replace workers or to cut back on hours that workers might have. So there is research that suggests that minimum wage increases do benefit a lot of workers, but they can cause what's called disemployment. And this means that it incentivizes employers to find new ways to replace their lowest skill workers.
Okay, thanks for your time, Wyatt.
You're welcome.
When you've had something for a really long time, it can be hard to give it up. And when that something is water, it's even harder, especially in the desert Southwest.
But that's exactly what's happening with the Colorado River. Drought and population growth are forcing tough conversations about who gets water and who has to cut back. Luke Runyon from KUNC has more.
If you've never seen the Hoover Dam up close, it's impressive. A massive concrete wall in a narrow canyon on the Arizona-Nevada border. At the visitor center, I join up with a tour group in hard hats. The dam holds Lake Mead, the country's largest human-made lake, in place. The Bureau of Reclamation's Zane Boyster is our guide. He leads us into an elevator.
We're going to be descending 537 feet the next 70 seconds, so you might have some pressure on your ears. That's normal.
We move through the cavernous structure, past the generators and pipes that move water from one side of the dam to the other. And at the first stop, Boyster brings up the elephant in the room, what we saw when we arrived. Lake Mead's glaringly white bathtub ring.
Somebody asked me the question about how much water is in Lake Mead. Is it low? And the answer is yes. You probably already know that. We're about 37-38% of capacity.
The lake's water comes from Rocky Mountain snowmelt, sent here via the Colorado River. But after 16 years of drought, the reservoir is more than half empty. When water managers divvied up the river in the 1920s, it was during a really wet period for the Colorado.
That's right. We overallocated the water from the very beginning. We're still tasked with honoring those same water contracts even today.
35 miles away in Las Vegas, water from the lake bubbles up from an ornate fountain inside Caesar's Palace. This is where water managers throughout the Colorado River Basin meet each winter to hash out their biggest problems. And right now, that's Lake Mead. Jeff Keitlinger is general manager of the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California.
It's rather clear that it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when the Colorado River goes into an official shortage.
The lake has been flirting with that shortage declaration for years. If triggered, cuts to water supplies for lower basin states like Arizona would be mandatory, not voluntary. The more the reservoir drops, the more drastic the cuts.
With that looming over us, we've been trying to figure out, are there ways we can cooperatively share this pain and make this whole situation easier?
Under the current system, Arizona would be hit the hardest. But an agreement in the works, called the Drought Contingency Plan, would, for the first time, place some of the burden on fast-growing California. Former Colorado River District Manager Eric Kuhn says that's a big change. In the past, conversations were about who would claim the next drop of the river's water.
Now we're talking about when we cut back, which we probably have to, who's going to take those cutbacks?
But even that might not be enough. Critics say the proposed drought plan is inadequate, a temporary patch. It doesn't address the so-called structural deficit. That's the river's imbalance between supply and demand. It's also leaving out climate change, which already saps some of the river's flow.
The future is going to look a lot like the last 20 years or so. Which means variable hydrology, some big wet years, but also some dry years. And those dry years are going to be aggravated by higher temperatures in the regions.
The drought plan has been in the works for 2 years now. It's an update to a series of guidelines agreed to in 2007. So what's at stake if the states can't come to an agreement?
It's really nothing less than the future of the West.
That's Mary Kelly. She runs a law firm specializing in Western water issues and represents environmental groups, cities, and foundations.
Do you want, vibrant agricultural communities? Do you want flowing rivers? And do you want cities that don't fall into crisis every other year.
Thank you. Great opportunity for pictures here, folks.
Back at the Hoover Dam, our attention turns back to snow and drought. Again, here's tour guide Zane Boyster.
I'm hoping that we reach that bottom when we're headed back out. Right now, it doesn't look too good. Not a lot of snowpack in the Rockies this year yet, but it still remains to be seen.
And as this winter continues, you can be sure Boyster and everyone else who works on all 1,400 miles of the Colorado River will be watching the level of Lake Mead. I'm Luke Runyon.
That story was produced in partnership with public media station KUNC in Northern Colorado, with financial support from the Walton Family Foundation.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Sebri.
And I'm Allison Bektesh. And Elizabeth, obviously, if people are listening to Mountain Edition, they want to be informed about local news.
Absolutely. One of the ways they can do this is by visiting Aspen Public Radio's Facebook page.
Check it out by searching Aspen Public Radio on Facebook. County has updated its plans to lessen the impacts of natural disasters like floods and wildfires.
The plan identifies the risk of natural hazards and how to minimize their impacts. The county's assessment shows that catastrophic wildfire is likely in the county and recommends mitigation work like removing dry trees and shrubs that could fuel such a fire. Pitkin is the first Colorado county to consider how climate change could impact natural hazards. The wildfire season will likely be longer and more intense. The county needs to update its plan every 5 years to remain eligible for federal assistance through FEMA. The public can comment on the draft plan through January 22nd.
Theater Aspen has announced its summer lineup in full, which now includes the pop rock musical Godspell.
Claire Woodcock sat down with producing director Jed Bernstein to talk about the production.
Godspell made its debut off-Broadway in 1971. It came to Broadway about 3 years later. It was written at the height of sort of the love child protest movement of the late 60s and early 70s. Stephen Schwartz, who wrote Wicked, wrote Godspell. It was his first big hit that had a revival on Broadway about 4 or 5 years ago. And it features a really pop award-winning score.
Day by day, day by day, oh dear Lord, three things I pray.
I'm very attracted to Godspell because I think on the one hand it has great appeal because of its message of friendship and inclusion and brother and sisterhood, but I also think it's a show that because of the unbridled free spirit of the telling of all the parables and the stories, it's going to have great appeal to kids and families. So I think it's a really nice way to round out our summer season, my first one.
When will auditions take place?
We're going to be having our equity auditions in Denver on Sunday, January 21, and we will be having our auditions in Aspen on Sunday, March 4 for all three shows.
Okay.
It continues to be a repertory company, meaning that our company, which assembles in early June for rehearsal, all of it will be in ragtime, and then everybody will be in at least one of the other two shows.
Oh, great. And will you also outsource in New York City as well?
We will. We're going to be auditioning in New York as well as college campuses around the country, probably 6 or 7 different colleges for our apprentice contingent. That is the portion of our company that are still in training, if you will, who are in college or graduate programs, and they will number about 6 or 7, and then 13 or 14 equity members for the rest of the company.
That's fabulous. Thanks, Jed.
Thanks so much.
That was Theater Aspen's new producing director, Jed Bernstein, who's picked the Stephen Schwartz musical Godspell to round out his first and the nonprofit's 35th summer season. I'm Claire Woodcock at the Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk.
Last month, the U.S. Forest Service released the environmental assessment of a new plan to manage visitors to Hanging Lake. Kristen Kay talked with Elizabeth about the potential impacts of limiting use to the popular spot.
So this plan is meant to protect this ecosystem. What's so special about it? And what did the environmental assessment show?
The ecosystem is unique. There's a rare lake formed by deposits of travertine and a hanging garden plant community. Those are spring-fed plants that grow from vertical cliff walls. There are fewer than 10 plant communities in Colorado that are like the one at Hanging Lake, and it's actually quite rare anywhere in the world. The environmental assessment looked at this in detail and shows that soil disturbance now means that there are more invasive species moving in that really threaten those rare hanging gardens. And the Forest Service says that the plan would improve soil and vegetation conditions for these rare plants. The assessment also showed that the plan will help protect the relatively undisturbed travertine formation. And if they don't implement the plan, it's likely that could be damaged.
So this plan would limit the number of visitors to Hanging Lake to 615 per day. And those people will take a shuttle instead of parking at the trailhead. So remind us, what are the issues there now?
So right now, there are more than 150,000 visitors per day. That number has grown exponentially over the past several years. The parking lot is getting full early in the day. So people are parking along the highway. They're parking on and off ramps. They're parking on sidewalks, sometimes even on grassy areas. And then all of those people who are clogging up the parking lot are also hitting the trail. So then there's damage to the trail, damage to the ecosystem. They found graffiti up there a couple summers ago. They say if no action is taken, all of this will continue to grow. Garfield County Search and Rescue would expect more emergency calls. The U.S. Forest Service can't keep up with maintenance at the trailhead or along the trail. It's likely that erosion will continue, these user conflicts will continue, and then, of course, continued damage to the ecosystem, too.
So the environmental assessment also takes economic impacts into account. What did that show?
Well, it would drop the number of daily visitors in those peak summer months from more than 1,000 per day now to 615. That could mean a reduction in tourist spending during those times. It's possible that some people might not be able to get a permit for the day or time that they're able to visit Hanging Lake, so then they might not choose to come to Garfield County at all, or they could choose to still come and just do something else. There will also be a fee associated with this plan. It's not clear what that will be yet, but it's possible that that could be a deterrent.
So what are the next steps here in this process?
The public can comment on the environmental analysis until January 22nd, and a draft decision will follow that period. The goal is to have the plan in place by May 2018, which is ahead of the next busy season.
Last week, State Senator Carrie Donovan, whose district includes Eagle, Pitkin, and Gunnison counties, was in Aspen for a town hall meeting. She joined Allison to talk about her priorities for this legislative session.
So the session starts on the 10th. What's on your to-do list this year?
For my district, the things that I've heard that I need to work on are still figuring out the broadband issue. How do we make sure all of Colorado is wired? And I'm really proud that I've been able to become a leader on that issue because I'm the only rural Democrat on the Senate side. And so, you know, speaking up for this issue is something that I've become a squeaky wheel on, but I'm a proud squeaky wheel. But I think this session will bring some movement on it.
You did have a couple bills about broadband that stalled out in committee. What's different this year?
I think what's different this year is my bills often die because of political reasons. That's just a fact of life in the Capitol. But if you continue to speak and fight for issue, you eventually get other allies. And so this year, you know, I may even see a Republican carry my bill from last year, which, you know, get it done. You know, if we get broadband out to rural communities and that mission is accomplished, then I'll call it a success if my name's on it or not.
As you said, a lot of the bills that you sponsor stall out in committee for political reasons. Do you feel effectual? Is it good enough that it's being discussed?
So there's a lot of different ways to be effective in the Capitol. So like one way that I've found is a process to get things accomplished is like through the budget process instead of running a bill. So that's how I got $9.4 million for broadband last year. It's how I got an ongoing funding source for a rural economic development program. So like we talk about bills because that's what we were taught in school is the way to accomplish things. But, you know, you make partnerships, you work on other bills, you run amendments to bills. And so, I mean, that's like the three-dimensional chess game that I love playing down there. So, yeah, they may kill my bills in committee because of the competitive seat that I'm in, but that doesn't mean I haven't been effective down there.
What else is on the docket for the 2018 session?
So healthcare is going to be a big issue. I attended an event this morning in Denver, and it was very interesting to finally hear the Denver Chamber talk about healthcare and talk about it in the same way as those of us that live in the mountains have been shouting about for like 5 years now.
And they're seeing some of these same issues where you have limited providers, limited options.
Yeah, limited providers is becoming an issue on the Eastern Plains. But we still have this problem of a lot of uncertainty from DC. And so how do we as a state react to not quite knowing what game we're even playing because we don't know the rules that are going to come out of DC?
In the time that you were on break, the General Assembly in Colorado, a lot of sexual harassment allegations came out about the state capitol, especially when you first got there. Is there that feeling of an old boys club in the state house?
I would say to different degrees. Almost every day that I've been in that building, there's been something that comes close to the line or crosses the line. And luckily for me, I have Senator in front of my name, which, you know, has empowered me, you know, to respond to some comments in ways that I don't think other, you know, someone who's a volunteer or an intern even has the ability, or a lobbyist whose job depends on relationships. We haven't believed women enough to have the conversation as openly as we're having it now. So I am really grateful that we as a nation are finally believing women. So, you know, in the Capitol, there is a little bit of an old boys club of, I think, just perhaps comments that certainly crossed the line. And I hope that's reset and reflected.
Senator Carrie Donovan, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Elizabeth Stewart Severy.
And I'm Allison Bechtesh. In other Aspen Public Radio news, the SALT took a page from Aspen's playbook and decided to bring a tobacco tax before voters.
Websites like Airbnb have made recent gains in Glenwood Springs, and the city council is looking at whether or not to let this trend continue.
Eagle County wants to jumpstart mental health services even before money from their new pot tax starts trickling in.
And Marble Distilling Company, based in Carbondale, has opened a second tasting room in Aspen.
Those stories and more news are on our website. Take a listen at aspenpublicradio.org. The Bureau of Land Management is taking public comment on a proposal for 4 new well pads near Rifle. It's the second phase of an ongoing project.
The company Terra Rocky Mountain received approval to develop 66 natural gas wells on BLM land last September. Now they want to drill an additional 63 in a second phase. The development in Balzac Gulch sits near the base of the Rhone Plateau, a biologically diverse stretch of public land among dense oil and gas activity. In 2014, the BLM canceled leases on the plateau as part of a settlement with environmental groups. That settlement maintained 12 leases below the rim. This proposal further develops one of those.
Colorado Mountain College is considering adopting a resolution in support of immigration reform.
Wyatt Orm reports.
If all 7 of CMC's trustees sign on, the college will officially stand for permanent immigration reform. Their resolution extols DACA, which are the Obama-era protections for immigrants who were brought to the U.S. illegally as children. Their resolution states the college's own DACA students are dedicated and hardworking. And it says that it is, quote, morally and economically imperative that Congress find a solution to keep these young people, who are otherwise known as dreamers, in the country and on a path to citizenship. The deadline for the vote is tomorrow. Wyatt Orm, Aspen Public Radio News.
Last month, veterans and service members from across America came to Aspen for Military Ski Week. It included a small group of women veterans working on a new mission. Elizabeth has the story.
Over 3 days, about a dozen female veterans, led by Zanetta Adams, planned a new network, the Military Sisterhood Initiative. Its goal is to connect women to each other and to resources for everything from mental health services to retreats like those offered by Challenge Aspen. Adams says that organization is part of the inspiration behind the Military Sisterhood Initiative and why she chose to launch the new program here in Aspen. Her first trip to the Roaring Fork Valley came a few years after she was injured while training to deploy for Operation Iraqi Freedom. She crushed discs and nerves in a fall from a 10-foot truck. She was told she'd never walk again, but slowly regained function while sinking into depression.
I ended up coming to a Challenge Aspen retreat for women veterans in 2009. And that kind of sparked the change in my life that you can see today. With that retreat, I was able to see other women who, in my mind, they were in a worse predicament than I was. They were missing limbs. Their husbands left them because they were not the same as when they went in. And I looked at my life and said, you know, how blessed am I? And also, how can I help them? And so that kind of helped me to get out of my depression.
Can you tell me a little bit more about that first retreat?
It was an eye-opener. So at the time, at least, there weren't many organizations that provide retreats for women veterans. I would go to retreats with other organizations. I wasn't getting what I needed. I'd always be the only female there. And so I didn't really have anybody to connect to. Or I'd have males that would say stupid, ignorant things that were very hurtful. And so you're like, I don't want to be in that environment. So I got isolated and I kind of shut off to myself. And one of those organizations was putting out information for Challenge Aspen about a women veterans retreat. Sarah Wolf Williams, who recently passed away, she was a good friend of mine and became my friend through this program. She said, hey, do you know any other female veterans? And I knew a bunch that had been injured in Iraq. And I put a call out to some of those people and they came together and it was great because I hadn't seen some of them in a while. And then I met some new people. Like I said, it was an eye opener because they understood what I was going through. You see that women are free to open up more. And so we're free to kind of tell our story. And that is, there's healing in that. That's where the connection came in. And that's where the healing came in. And it wasn't just the women. It was the strength of the organization and the people that they had. It didn't feel like I was going to an organization where I was just a number or a poster child. When they bring you into Challenge Aspen, it's like family, and you have a family for life.
Can you talk a little bit about what it's like to rejoin the civilian world?
I think that coming back as a civilian, there's so many different variables and differences between a woman coming back. When I got called up to go to Iraq, I had three kids at home. I had a five-year-old and almost two-year-old twins. And my husband was at home with them because he was in the military too. In my mind, had he gone and come back, there's already this expectation amongst everybody that he has to acclimate and he has to, you know, come back and get back in the swing of things. It's going to take time, not for women. You know, when you come back and you're a mom and you're a wife, you just, okay, you're back, get back in your role. And so you don't have time to decompress and become a civilian again. And before you know it, it's kind of like you've lost yourself. And so that's one of the things that females face. Another thing is that when you're injured in the military as a female, you know, when I was in my wheelchair with my cane and I'm in my 20s, people weren't like, oh, you must have served. That's how you got injured. No. You know, but you see a young male, you know, missing a leg or whatever. That's the first assumption. That's the first assumption. And so then you have to validate yourself and revalidate yourself and reprove yourself. And it gets exhausting. But that is your role, your mom and wife. And so you put everybody else first again and you put yourself last. And that's why I think you've seen a rise in suicide among women veterans. You've seen a rise in suicide among women veterans where they take their children out as well. And so we're hoping that with this connectivity, with this initiative, with all of these things, we can help combat that as well.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Zanetta Adams, a retired U.S. Army veteran who was heading up the Military Sisterhood Initiative. She spoke with Elizabeth while she was in Aspen last month.
That's all for Mountain Edition this week. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy.
And I'm Allison Bechtesh. You can find more news from the Roaring Fork Valley and from all around the world on our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Tune in to Valley Roundup tomorrow at 3:30. Allison will discuss the most important stories of this week with a panel of local reporters.
Of course, it's going to be a great time. Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.